Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So two editors and a professor walk into a studio. It's the start of a joke. We hope not. That's the start of a radio program. Welcome to the Media Project, folks. Before a live audience this week, I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, joined here by Judy Patrick, editor of the Gazette, the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. Howdy, Judy.
Hello, Rex.
I never thought that's a nice little howdy, Judy. And then there is the professor, Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. How'd you do?
How's yourself?
Not so bad. Thank you very much. So here we are anyway. We are at the Linda, the Performing Arts Studio of WAMC, where we're before a group called OASIS. I won't try to do the acronym, but it is the Lifelong Learning Program based at the University of Albany, and we're happy to have the folks with us today as we do the program. Wow. Very nice. So here we are, ready to take on the world or to do a little bit of analysis, commentary, and if we're lucky, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. Dr. Chartok, you have some mail, I believe.
Okay.
Tell us what you
mail,
hear.
But I don't have it with my glasses, but all right. Dear Dr. Chartok, spelled wrong, maybe you could ask Rick Smith during your journalism show about the ethics of the Times Union policy.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Can we all say that? Oh, boy. If you have submitted a letter, a nice woman from India. Is that where they would call you from?
No, Azra Haki, actually. She sits right outside my office, but I know okay. Azra. She's actually from Pakistan.
Oh, she really thought she was getting, from India calls to confirm if she wrote the letter. Then she asks, did you submit the letter to any other newspaper? Worse, I find that the letters are not always published in the paper. In other words, just because you send a letter doesn't mean you're going to get it published. No other paper operates this way. This is the key sentence, my friends. No other paper operates this way. By demanding exclusivity for a letter offered free, the TU is acting in a typically totalitarian fashion.
Typically totalitarian. Great. Alliterative, too.
The honorable policy would be to publish good letters quickly, scoop the trade, and be known as responsive to public opinion. I would like you to keep my name confidential. I wonder why.
Yeah, okay. We'll get that person.
Okay, so that raises an interesting question, doesn't it? I just want you all to know I wrote her back, and I said, well, maybe no other paper does it, but the New York Times does. And now, Judy, what do you do with your paper?
We don't publish letters that have been published elsewhere. We want original letters. We get a lot of letters to choose from, and why should we print something that's been somewhere else?
Absolutely.
Now, in Berkshire County, where I live, a good place, the newspapers do publish everything, so the Berkshire Record and the Berkshire Eagle will publish the same record.
The problem is that there's a limited amount of space, and we get so many letters that if we published a lot of this stuff, we need to make room for stuff that people write that is unique. You know, why would we give people something that they can read anywhere else? There's also this phenomenon that editorial page editors refer to as AstroTurf, which is a supposed grassroots effort that is actually manufactured by organizations. So it may look like it's a genuine letter to the editor, but it has exactly the same phrases as two other letters that just arose, that just came in, and we will not publish those either. If it's an organized campaign that appears to be orchestrated and not the real words of people, it's, you know, there's something to thinking this kind of stuff through.
You know, that's so interesting that you raise that, Rex, this idea of organized campaigns, because just this week in our area here. Of course, you know, if you're listening in Nacogdoches, Texas, you're going to just have to, if they still are listening.
I think the time of the day that this program airs in Nacogdoches, Texas, nobody's listening but the cows.
Well, in any case, there's a guy who is running for Congress as we speak, and he asked to be, quite correctly, asked to be on WAMC, where we're doing this. And I said, of course. And his name is Joel Tiner. We had him on twice. And then I had four people in a row call me up and say, how come you've never interviewed Joel Tiner on WAMC? And I said, who told you that? Knowing full well who told him that. And I said, I have to tell you, this is a prevarication. We've had him on twice. No, you haven't. We heard that officially. So, you know, there can be these campaigns. Now, when four people call you up in the course of a spate of a couple of days, mm-hmm. you know you're being had. Now, this week...
I just want to point out, by the way, that the professor used a five-syllable word to substitute for the word lie, which is one. No, here we go.
Well, I was thinking. I was thinking about it, I'll tell you. So this week, his campaign finance person resigned because he hadn't been submitting voucher, you know, requests for money. And he said something which I thought was incredible. He said, don't ever question me about money. I don't even have enough money to pay my mother the rent that I owe her.
Right.
Now, that's extraordinary. So,
it's a grassroots campaign. So, that's what that is.
so there you are. Which means, are we capable, are we automatons as journalists, of never making up our minds about somebody based on the fact that they have really ticked us off? And ticked is a substitute word also, right?
Mm-hmm. A shorter one.
A shorter one. Well, do you mean, do we handle something differently if somebody has ticked us off? Do we treat them?
Yes, do we give them a special send-off?
Don't you feel, I don't know, Judy?
I mean, you heard the story I just told.
Yeah.
That might be a perfect example of the very fact that I told that story. You know what I mean?
And use the candidate's name so that it might reflect badly on him to the listeners of this program. So there you go. I think
I like the guy's platform a lot. But then the other thing that happened at the end of the week is the guy he's been quoting, Maurice Hinchey, endorsed his opponent, Mr. Schreiben. Now, you see, I said that just mm-hmm. now.
Uh-huh.
Now, you, Rex, ran a story on your front page today, talking about how money for his opponent is coming from outside the district, which is interesting because, you see, one could almost suspect that you were for Tiner by the fact that you gave such a tough time to Schreiben.
Well, one could suspect that we were doing journalism.
We were paying attention
to where money comes from. I mean, I think that's a legitimate story. Where is the money coming from to support a congressional candidate? We'll do the same thing in the fall when the Republican that one of them is facing off against, Chris Gibson, is in the race. There isn't any out-of-district money coming into Mr. Tiner's campaign because there's no money at all. So I think that you're always looking, Alan, for the ghosts behind the platform. Who are we for and who we're against? And I'm trying to say that we're just trying to be fair and try to do a good job of journalism, but it's not who we like and who we don't like. We're just trying to be reporters here.
Right. Every day when you put out a newspaper or you produce a radio show, you have to put things aside, or better yet, you have to... I don't like people or dislike people. I have basically no opinion about things. I just have proceed as if the journalism is the most important part. I don't tend to get ticked off about one thing or another. People are always yelling at me or praising me, but you kind of get used to it and it rolls off your back so you can make those kind of decisions about what's a really interesting story.
Now, Judy Patrick, you have no more devoted follower than me. Nobody. I mean, I just think you're wonderful. I do.
But what is this business?
I don't have any opinions. Everybody has opinions. You know, we could give you a Rorschach test and put a red thing up in front of you and a black thing up in front of you, you know, and we could tell based on neurotransmission or reflective feedback whether you like red or black better.
Well, you know, I may have an opinion about whether a congressman is quotable or not, or whether or not it's a good story, but the congressman personally, no opinion.
You know, I feel a little bit differently. I'm more opinionated than that, actually. I just feel that the important thing for journalists is that our professional training and our experience suggest that we don't let those opinions affect our work. Isn't that the case?
It's very, very true, because it's almost like it's squished into a back part of your mind. And maybe you can start to think about things from a personal perspective when you're in the middle of a hike back in the woods of the Adirondacks. But it's when you come to the news meeting, when you read the stories before they go into the paper, it's not even part of the equation at all. It's not in the front part of my head at all.
Which is interesting because Judy Patrick, as you may know, has just been appointed the editor of our newspaper, the Schenectady paper. She was the longtime managing editor of the paper. So now instead of having to do one job, she has to do two jobs.
This is a great honor.
Judy, let me ask you something about that. Are you, because this is something that has affected my life, are you involved in the editorial page?
You know, I'm not. And traditionally at the Gazette, the editorial page editors work on their own. But interesting, now that I'm editor, I can start to think about changing things. And so I may get involved.
I've done that. When I came to the Times Union, I came as managing editor for news, and I was not a part of the editorial page. And then traditionally, the editor sat on the editorial board. And it is a difficult thing. At a smaller paper, when I was the editor of the paper in Troy, I wrote all the editorials for 4 years. And that you find in a smaller newspaper, that's typically the case. The bigger the paper, the more independence, there just are enough hands on deck that you don't have to be as involved. But and it's a difficult line to straddle, I think, between opinion and the straight news.
I have to just say, for the record, I would be a hypocrite if I didn't say that at this point. Your predecessor had likes and dislikes as the editor of the paper.
The one who's now in Houston as editor of the Houston Chronicle?
No, I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'm so sorry. His predecessor.
All right.
Not lacking to do names here of this kind. He had his likes and dislikes, and I think it showed up in the way in which the paper was organized. I'll be perfectly honest with you.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion. You have your likes and dislikes, and that is very heavily reflected in the programming of WAMC.
Really?
So there you go.
Like what?
Well,
like this program?
For example. No, and I think you play to your audience at public radio. You know who is primarily in your audience, and I know you're going to cite, what's his name?
Herb London.
Herb London. Oh, my God. The dumbest conservative in America.
The dean of the NYU dean with a PhD? Who's the head of
it?
You're telling me that he's the dumbest conservative in America?
Have you two had this conversation before?
I think so.
Anyway, we're just rolling them out. We give them little numbers. It's 23. This is, if you're just joining us, folks, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok over there, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. And, along this line is the use of some terms. We had a conversation the other day about the use of the term Obamacare, and I was complaining about that is a word that seems to me that is loaded and inappropriate for use in straight journalism stories. It's shorthand. Same kind of a thing here. Here's a new study about the word job killer, which is one of those terms that there has been now research done by a pair of professors that has found that the term job killer has been used almost three times as often in the Wall Street Journal since 1984 as it has in the New York Times. It's a pejorative term, I would think, any way you cut it. But it seems to, and I'm not talking about opinion pieces. This is in news stories.
Right, and I was surprised by the number of times it was in the Associated Press stories as well. And one of the points the article is trying to make is the fact that it's used sometimes in direct quotes, but it's also never, the journalist who's writing the story never takes the next step and sees whether or not whatever they're talking about actually will reduce the number of jobs. And that's the really important part that needs to be in any story.
Absolutely, to the truth test, right?
Right, and job killer is jargon. It's one of the things we are talking to reporters all the time about is to avoid jargon. They think it's easier to write the story if they just say job killer, but it's longer to explain it, but it's more important to the reader that we really let them know what's happening.
But don't you both understand? You know, I'm at a real disadvantage here, to be honest with you, because both of you are very, very handsome people, aren't they? And they look down upon me because I'm short and, have...
And very tired looking today.
And not the same, aplomb or princely qualities that both of them have. But don't you understand that you've just heisted yourselves on your own petards by saying... pointing out that here was the Wall Street Journal doing their brand of journalism based on their conservatism, the very thing that you were both denying.
Well,
I speak for myself, and I can't speak for the Wall Street Journal. I think that every day in our newspaper, we make mistakes. Every day journalism makes mistakes. We do a lot of really great things, but we make mistakes all the time. There's one of the articles is about the restaurant that was named, was incorrectly named. We make very bad errors. I mean, it's silly errors, some that make us laugh every day in the newsroom, and some very egregious errors that we have to correct and apologize for. But when it comes to Job Killer, I sure hope it wasn't in the Gazette. I'm going to go back and do an archive search and see if we've used it.
You know, Judy's point, though, is that it's used in a quote, and then do you clarify? So it may be that it's just that the Wall Street Journal has quoted a lot more people. But I like your answer. I speak for myself. That point that she was making about you do the best you can under the circumstances. The restaurant in Canada, it's a newspaper called the Hamilton Spectator. The restaurant is called Sarcoa. And unfortunately, the Hamilton Spectator, in writing about this new waterfront eatery, referred to the restaurant as sarcoma, which is, of course, is a form of cancer. And they wrote a correction that said the name of a Hamilton waterfront restaurant, Sarcoa, was misspelled. It was misspelled, yes. But that, and it said the Spectator regrets the error. I'll bet they do. Yeah. You do. You make mistakes. You do the best you can under the circumstances. And when you consider the thousands of words in every edition of the newspaper, you try hard. And you hope that you don't make too many mistakes. More egregious, the sins of omission, of not clarifying when a word is loaded, and we don't let that.
Don't you people have copy editors anymore?
Yes, we do. We have fewer copy editors than we used to, but
They put in sarcoma, they're not enough.
No, most stories get maybe four reads. Errors still get through. Headlines still have misspelled words in very large type.
We're just pulling back on a change that we made a couple of years ago. We made a newsroom organizational change designed to bring what we called content editors into the conversation earlier. And we've had, I think, too many errors as a result in part of this change. So we're actually going back to the traditional form of a copy desk in a newsroom, which has a key position in newsrooms is the slot, which is the person who
sits in the slot.
Sits in the slot.
He doesn't sit in the slot anymore because it was a desk with a slot in it. And that person would sit in that slot and dispense the articles to the copy editors who surrounded
him. Like a horseshoe.
Like a horseshoe. And that person was in charge of things funneled through him and funneled back out through him. Almost always a man.
We've recreated the slot. We think that will give us an extra read and we'll have fewer errors because we've had so many errors over the past few months that we just got to the point of saying there has to be a structural problem that is causing this. Well, and part of the problem is we have fewer eyes on stories than we used to.
We all make mistakes. Neither of us should feel badly. When my wonderful wife, who will hate me for telling this story, published her first book, it was on the Holocaust. And the Anti-Defamation League put out 50,000 copies of it. And she was very excited as she opened up the first box of them. And the name of the book was The Holocaust Year Society on Trial. And she looked at the binder, which is what was facing her from the box, and it said, The Holocaust Year's Society on Trail.
Mm. Oh, dear.
50,000 copies.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. So she called the guys at the publisher, and when she told them what happened, there was a scream at the other end and said five people had signed off on the entire thing. So we all make mistakes.
Oh,
even on public radio, we make a few.
No. You know, as I was saying, the bigger sin is a sin of omission, and that is an interesting point made by a study looking at the health care law, the Affordable Care Act, which has been so much in the news as a result of the Supreme Court action on it. Question about the communication effort. There has been a lot of talk about the fact that the administration failed to communicate effectively to people what was in the legislation. But there has been a responsibility on the part of the press as well. It's virtually vanished in terms of the actual elements of the law. It has virtually vanished in the run-up to the Supreme Court decision. People have written about the politics of it, but not about the reality of it. It's a very difficult thing to explain. During the debates, when we tried to explain to people with front page stories, there really is no such thing as a death panel in the healthcare bill. I would get angry phone calls and letters from people saying, there you go, defending Obama.
Perception is everything, you know. But part of this, Rex, is knowing your audience. And to me, they should have known from the Hillary healthcare attempt that the more complicated it is, the harder it is to ever explain anything. So, for example, if you had said, as I wanted them to, it's going to be Medicare for all, and you know the Medicare that we all have, I have it, it works well, and it's going to work well for everybody else too, and then there wouldn't have been any of this gobbledygook going on. So,
well, people don't understand complex things, even simple things. I'm reading a book which opens with a scene in which an author recounts a guy at a demonstration holding a sign that says, keep your government hands off my Medicare. Well, Medicare is a government program. It is a fundamental lack of understanding of what's going on that leads to that kind of thinking, you know.
Yeah, and part of the problem is when the law was first passed, we rushed to do these stories, and the rollout was so long. You know, this isn't going to happen right away. This is going to happen a year from now or 2 years from now. And so we couldn't get the answers we wanted about the impact in the local community. People didn't know. It's almost like the immigration story from last week is we reached out to people, and no, they didn't know yet about what was happening. And also, people really don't believe this healthcare law is going to affect them much, and so we're not getting a lot of reader response. We run letters to the editor about it. We run some op-ed pieces, but again, early on, especially in that first year, it was so hard to get information from government sources, even to explain what was going to happen and when, even from our congressman.
It's a complex concept, and the public isn't good at understanding, and we are not that good at explaining concepts.
Why isn't the public so good at understanding? Are you calling them stupid?
Well, I'm saying that the issue of health care insurance is so complex that most Americans are not.
Okay, but yes or no, do we have a dumbed-down society? And if we have a dumbed-down society, let's face it, it's very hard to explain things to them.
You know, have you talked to a senior citizen about the Epic Plan, which provides drugs, low-cost drugs? They really know the complexity of that program fairly well, so that reassures me that they can get into a topic very easily. I think if they really have a vested interest in it, they can learn. On healthcare, I think the debate has gotten muddied by the politics of it all, because people listen to cable news, they listen to other kinds of radio shows, and the debate gets distorted, and they don't get to understand the complexity of it. It's a good bill, it's a bad bill, there are all sorts of impacts with it, but I think it has to be explained over time, and it's not just one story is going to do it. It's going to be a series, and you need to have people who know what they're talking about talk to reporters and explain it.
You know, having taken, by the way, a swing earlier at public radio, I have to say that I think that on this station on public radio, there have been significant efforts to explain this legislation very effectively. But when Judy said other kinds of radio programs, I think we know what she's talking about. I mean, I think talk radio is a pox on society. And the folks who are putting out stuff mostly on the AM band and giving us this talk are very casual with the truth. So there we go.
That's
casual
another,
with the truth.
That's another, it's another word, another synonym. For,
yes.
For you know.
Prevarication.
Prevarication. It's a lie. They're a bunch of liars.
We are out of time, sadly, and we're very grateful to our crowd from OASIS, the Lifelong Learning Program of the University of Albany, for joining us. We're, of course, grateful to our producer, David Gustina, and Adam Claremont, who has engineered this program here at the Linda, the Performing Arts Studio of WAMC. Judy Patrick of the Daily Gazette.
She's the best.
How about
nice
that?
To be here.
Dr. Alan Chartok, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on The Media Project.
About some charming people I have known, or I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. floor. I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.